including Ms. Vincent's.
Excuse me.
This is a PFR. And so, Mr. Krieger, I believe you go first. Good morning to you and also to Ms. Vincent again. Do either of you have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
Especially about who goes first.
May it please the court, I'm Bob Krieger. I represent Nate Harms. Mr. Harms filed for post-conviction relief from his conviction for possession of child pornography. In his first post-conviction proceeding, he alleged in his first claim essentially that he was generally incompetent throughout the proceeding. And in his second claim, he argued that at least at the time of his plea, he lacked the mental capacity to enter into a voluntary waiver of his rights based on his mental state. The trial court denied the petition without a hearing. Court of Appeals affirmed that decision, concluding that the competency claims he raised, count one and two, were procedurally barred. This court granted further review to review the sole issue of whether those competency claims were in default and barred. In his first claim and his second claim, Harms relied on State versus Johnson, a decision of this court in 1996.
Of this court?
Court of Appeals, perhaps?
I mean, excuse me, the Court of Appeals.
Yeah. We're veterans of the Court of Appeals.
No,
you knew that would happen.
I'm ahead of myself. Because it doesn't matter. Yes, it says right here, Court of Appeals.
It's right there.
To the proposition that a claim of incompetence is not subject to a procedural bar. But then this court in State versus Johnson, without overruling State versus Watkins, without overruling, I'm not doing it very good today, said that it may be subject, those claims may be subject to a procedural bar. In essence, the Court of Appeals, looking at the history of the cases, also relied on State versus Ryan for its conclusion that these claims were procedurally barred.
But Ryan was a second post.
Excuse me?
The Bryan case was a second
and
post.
That's
and Watkins was a second post.
Yes.
So, we're looking for the something a little more factually on point, if it exists. Or
well,
does it?
No, mine is a first.
There you go.
And that's the question. The question is, did the Court of Appeals incorrectly apply those two decisions to bar a claim looking at competency that was first raised in the first post-conviction claim as an ineffective assistance of trial counsel and failing to raise it on direct appeal, and an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel who is different counsel on appeal?
You, of course, recognize that State versus Johnson as a decision of the Court of Appeals is not binding on this court. I suspect you hope to persuade us that we should follow that, and I'm interested to hear your reasons why.
Well, I suspect the reason why you took this case may be to answer that question, right?
I think that's a pretty shrewd
and
assumption.
It seems to me that you start with a proposition, whether it comes from the Court of Appeals, with authority that says, you know, general competency is a due process question. It is at the bedrock of the voluntariness of decisions made by defendants to accept plea agreement, whatever. General competence is generally a claim not waived. This court or the court of, however you want to get there, you can argue by the time you're into a successor motion for post-conviction relief, right, in which you're not entitled to effective assistance of counsel, all those types of bars, right, might rise to the level of denying a claim that relates to competency of the accused, either generally or specifically at a plea hearing.
Now,
well,
here, go ahead.
So, in Johnson, and maybe this is or isn't important to the proposition for which you on which you rely, there was no direct appeal. It was the first appellate examination of competency. Whereas here, correct me if I'm wrong, there was a direct appeal. So, does that matter?
No, because you have a right to an effective assistance of counsel at trial and on your initial direct appeal. That is fundamentally established. this claim to the extent that it argues, it's a layered claim. Claim three just preserves those first two claims as an ineffective assistance of trial counsel for letting it get this far in the first place. And my best point, I think, the record in this case is silent on the whole issue of the defendant's competence at the time of the plea hearing. It is a failure of the colloquy between the court and the defendant to even address the question of competency when there was evidence in the plea hearing to suggest an inquiry was
required.
Absolutely. I believe we have Boykin, right? We have the basic fundamental rights that you're supposed to waive freely and voluntarily. But here we have a defendant who says, look, I haven't been on my medication. I've got mental health problems. And the court just goes right past it and doesn't even engage.
So assuming we were not procedurally barred and you're addressing the merits of whether or not the pigeonhole of what the lawyer did or didn't do well, but what the court should have picked up on, right?
It might have even been plain error if it wasn't raised.
But the due process that the court should have noticed, is this what you're saying, at the plea hearing when he said, I've been off my meds, they started them up 2 days ago, I'm on Lexapro, I'm not myself, that should have, at that point at the plea, triggered something by the court. Is that your argument, sort of?
Two people. The lawyer and the judge.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I've been at this way too long. I can probably recite the colloquy that the trial courts give on the question of, do you understand the nature of the proceedings? Are you thinking clearly? Are you under the influence? Is your and then they conclude by, I conclude beyond a reasonable doubt by observing the defendant, by his bearing, by his speech, by his manner, that he's answering my questions soon. There is a whole colloquy that goes, and I find beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant understands the nature of the charges. Nothing like that appears in the record in this case. I was in this court when I heard the arguments about the case where the county judge gave a waiver to the crowd, the group, before the session. And the last thing he said, and if you plead guilty, you waive your right to counsel. I said, really? To myself. This court said, you can't do that. Your colloquy, even an error as simple as saying you waive your right to counsel to somebody that pleaded guilty invalidated the plea on direct appeal. This problem is not a problem that is coming in to the case from the outside. This is a problem with the case on the inside. And all Mr. Harms said is, look, do what you do in every other case. I'm telling you this is what my allegation is. He's made specific factual allegations about his mental health history. And there's nothing in the record to refute it. We would normally say that that then requires a hearing on the claim. Just fundamentally, this isn't a witness he didn't call. This is a flaw in the process that was available to trial counsel if they'd done their homework. The allegation is that it was a failure to investigate and raise this issue by trial counsel. And then after the plea hearing, a different lawyer took the case, read the same transcript I did and that you did, and you'd have to notice the obvious problem. And on direct appeal, I would submit that if I argue this case to you, just like the case where the judge said you waive your right to counsel, you would say this record is inadequate to answer the question and send it back for a hearing. If you read all of the allegations that Mr. Harms made about the reason that he wasn't confident on that day, there's plenty of factual allegations that, if true, would clearly have informed the trial court that we ought not have this plea hearing today. Or counsel could have alerted the court to be much more careful.
Counsel, before your time completely runs out, I'm following your layered claim analysis, but I'm still having problems short of using ineffective assistance of direct appellate counsel, how we get to the underlying issue of competence, because it was not raised on direct appeal. And how do we say that you can never waive those? Clearly in Watkins, we rejected that notion.
But that's second Third.
It was second. I grant you, it was a second post-conviction.
We're in the direct lane. We are in something that should have been handled by trial court, should have been raised by direct appeal when the record supports it.
And you're mixing those two together, and I'm wondering if we should, you're mixing the trial court should have done.
No, trial lawyer should have done.
Well, that's the part, that's the second part. That's the ineffective assistance.
Of trial counsel.
Of trial and appellate counsel, because you concede this is a layered claim. It wasn't raised on direct appeal. So maybe we're circling around saying
I think this is an easy case. This is not complicated, in my opinion. You have to work to figure out why Mr. Harms shouldn't get a hearing on a claim that is sitting there in the record that the trial court did not eliminate by a plea colloquy that could have ended this discussion.
Okay.
And so in the absence of evidence in the record to refute the claims that he's making, the factual claims that he's making, the only choice was to have a hearing. It could have happened when trial counsel handled the plea hearing. It should have happened when the appellate counsel failed to raise it or preserve it for post-conviction review. And as far as I know, both state and federal law give you that effective assistance of counsel right through the direct appeal. So it's a layered claim, but the claim is right there.
Okay, thank you.
So we believe the Court of Appeals erred in finding the claim to be procedurally barred. The record doesn't refute the claim. The allegations of fact certainly suggest there is a problem with the plea, and it should be remanded for an evidentiary hearing. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you very much. Ms. Vincent, good morning again.
May it please the Court, my name is Melissa Vincent, and I represent the appellee, the state of Nebraska. Harms claims the Court of Appeals erred as a matter of law by finding his competency claim was procedurally barred because Watkins did not overrule Johnson. I disagree. The Court of Appeals held that competency claims are never procedurally barred, and in Watkins, this Court disagreed. Specifically, this Court held that regardless of the importance of the claim, the need for finality in the judicial process requires the defendant to raise it at the earliest opportunity or it is procedurally barred. Here, the Court of Appeals properly applied Watkins. Court found that Harms' claim was procedurally barred because, one, he failed to raise it on direct appeal, two, he failed to allege the defense was not available to him before, and three, nothing in the plea colloquy or his allocution at sentencing suggested that he was not competent. The latter point is significant because, as this Court has repeatedly stated, the trial court is not required to make a competency determination in every case where a defendant seeks to plead guilty. Rather, a competency determination is necessary only when a court has reason to doubt the defendant's competence.
Assume that we throw in with you on everything you've said up to this moment.
Sure.
How does that dispose of the layered claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel?
Okay. I was getting to that.
Okay.
I think this is, you know, procedurally barred. The due process claim certainly is procedurally barred, but I think the Court of Appeals also correctly determined that the ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim was procedurally barred because he had different counsel on appeal, and his counsel could have raised it but did not. So he was limited to a layered claim at that point. He has to allege my appellate counsel is ineffective for failing to allege my trial counsel was. But there, the Court of Appeals rejected it due to insufficient allegations, and I agree that those allegations were insufficient. He merely faulted his trial counsel for failing to investigate whether he was competent. He did not allege any facts showing that his mental health issues rendered him unable to meet the modest aim of legal competency, as that phrase has been defined in our case law. Indeed, he's never even acknowledged that definition. But in any event, I think it was insufficiently pled and properly denied without an evidentiary hearing. So I agree with the Court of Appeals analysis. I think they got it right. And I will just mention one other thing, because when I was reading the PFR, I kind of got the impression that because Fincher, Ryan, and Watkins all involved successive post-conviction motions, that he was sort of reading Watkins to say, okay, you can still raise it on, you know, direct appeal in your first post-conviction motion, but it's only successives where we're going to impose a procedural bar, and I don't agree with that either. I mean, procedural bars are procedural bars. They're applied uniformly to all claims in post-conviction cases, and I think that the fact that all of those were successive post-conviction motions was just happenstance.
Do you, does it matter, I think this is the same question I was asking Mr. Krieger, I think, does it matter when we're looking for the underlying factual procedural history that there was or was not a direct appeal?
Yes.
To determine procedural bar in the first post-conviction?
Yes. I mean, I think that was a very important fact in Johnson, and that coupled with the fact that, you know, there was obvious evidence.
So in Johnson, there was no direct appeal.
Correct.
It was the first post-conviction, and the Court of Appeals said not barred.
Yes, and they essentially found, as I read the opinion, they essentially found plain error by the district court. So if the, you know, they could have...
Well, it got rejected on the merits at the end of the day.
Well, no, I mean, they sent it back. Because they said, well, you have this substantive due process claim not to plead incompetent. And then they found that the procedure that the court employed in that case was procedurally inadequate, constitutionally inadequate. So they sent it back, unless I'm mistaken about that. But that was my understanding, was that they eventually ended up reversing and sending it back for another hearing, essentially. In that case, that was the troublesome aspect of it, because if that case had gone up on direct appeal, presumably the Court of Appeals would have reached the same determination. And that's another issue that I have here is, well, we had a direct appeal. And so if there were plain error, you know, presumably the Court of Appeals would have caught the error when it was down there, and then he filed the PFR, and this court denied the PFR.
Are you familiar, pardon me, with this, how do you pronounce it, SoFly, S-A-U-F-L-Y, opinion from the Court of Appeals?
Softly?
Softly. Softly.
Yes,
that
was my case, actually.
Yeah. I beg your pardon. Okay. Well, what's the lesson there, if any?
I'm not sure I know what you mean.
Well, then, in Softly there, the outcome was not procedurally barred and followed Johnson.
Well, that's because he didn't file a direct appeal.
And that's a no direct appeal, right?
Right.
I'm looking for commonalities here, or maybe my matrix is useless.
No, you're right. And I think in that case I said, well, ordinarily. I argued that ordinarily you can't assert plain error because that's how he tried to raise it. I said, you can't, but there Johnson's out there and says if you didn't have a direct appeal, then you can raise the competence for the first time in your... In your first post-conviction.
In your first post.
Exactly.
Right. But there was a little bit of the record in front of the court in connection with the pleas and so forth may have led a court to wonder about competence.
Well, that's
is that not correct?
That's
this is
alleged.
If I remember the facts, we've got a defendant who had a plea deal down from 5 to 2 counts and said, no, I want to plead to 5.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the trial judge is going, huh? So...
Right.
Maybe something.
And all the sentences
explored.
In that case were imposed concurrently, as I recall.
Okay.
But I think, you know, the issue there was I didn't agree with him that there was evidence of incompetence. I mean, he was represented by the commission in that case, and his attorney had extensive discussions about the plea deal. And it's like, you understand, you know, that there's no plea deal and you're pleading to these 5 charges. And he said, yeah, I want to do it. And then in the PSI, he, you know, acknowledged that he committed the offense. He tried to apologize to the victim. I mean, he gave a cogent allocution, much like we have in this case. I mean, factually, I have a very hard time with this claim because I don't think there's anything in this record.
Because this defendant did a cogent allocution with respect to the underlying crimes.
Yes. It was extremely lengthy. It was very detailed. It was cogent. And it was followed by a lengthy argument by his counsel where she also made a number of representations about his understandings of, you know, the charges and why he was entering his plea. He didn't dispute any of that. He apparently wrote a 17-page letter to friends and family explaining to them what he had done. And then he wrote a lengthy sentencing letter to the judge herself. So I'm like, well, at some point, and presumably a PSI was prepared in that case. And again, no red flags for anyone, not the state, not defense counsel, not the court, nobody. And then you want to come in now and say, well, you know, after you got whacked at sentencing, you want to come in now and say, well, gee, I wasn't competent. And, you know, and the thing about the motion itself is you have to tie those allegations. You have to explain to me, like, what happened leading up to that plea hearing that put your counsel on notice that maybe you weren't tracking or that there was a problem. And, you know, none of that happened. There's no allegations there. And then again, you know, you're looking at what happened after the sentencing or after the plea hearing and thinking, well, okay, let's assume for a moment you were in the throes of a panic attack or that you weren't competent. Well, what evidence do we have of that 6 weeks later at sentencing? Why didn't he move to withdraw his plea? Why didn't he, you know, express some confusion as to why he was here? I don't even know what I'm doing here. I didn't mean to plead to these. I mean, we got none of that from this record. So I argued in the Court of Appeals that this was refuted by the record based on everything that transpired. I think, you know, they didn't decide it that way. I don't think they needed to based on the way they actually resolved the case with the insufficient allegations, and I'm fine with that, and I haven't challenged that in my own PFR, but... You know, again, I have a tremendous amount of difficulty with this claim just based on what is in the record. that we can review. So I don't know if that answers everyone's questions, but if there's nothing further, I would submit that the Court of Appeals' opinion was correct and should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
There you are.
Thank you, counsel. You are excused, and the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is State versus Simons.